cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he drove.
This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. We continue reading this week from The Log of a Cowboy, a narrative of the old trail days by Andy Adams. This volume was published in Boston and New York by Houghton Mifflin and Company in 1903. The Log of a Cowboy is an autobiographical account of a five-month drive of 3,100 cattle from Brownsville, Texas, to the Blackfeet Indian Agency in Montana in 1882, along the Great Western Cattle Trail. The cattle belong to Don Lovell, the renowned cowman and drover. He does not accompany the drive, although he does put in a cameo appearance during this episode. He entrusts the responsibility for the drive to his experienced foreman, Jim Flood. Adams' log is a classic and authentic description of trailmen and their work, cow horses, and range cattle. Although strictly speaking the book is fiction, it is firmly based on Adams' personal experiences on the trail, and it is considered by many to be the best account of cowboy life in literature. As we rejoin Andy and his crew of cowpokes, they've brought the herd, originally assembled from numerous Mexican rancheros, across the Rio Grande, dealt with rustlers, struggled to contain two stampedes, negotiated with one group of Indians while avoiding others, and labored through an arduous crossing of the South Branch of the Canadian River in Oklahoma. They are now proceeding northward around Camp Supply, an army post in Oklahoma near the point of the Texas Panhandle. I remind you that our stories are usually edited for recording. There was never very much love lost between government soldiers and our tribe, so we swept past Camp Supply in contempt a few days later and crossed the North Fork of the Canadian to camp for the night. Flood and McCann went into the post as our supply of flour and navy beans was running rather low, and our foreman had hopes that he might be able to get enough of these staples from the sutler to last until we reached Dodge. He also hoped to receive some word from Lovell. You'll recall that Don Lovell is the owner of this outfit. The rest of us had no lack of occupation as a result of a chance find of mine that morning. Honeyman had stood my guard the night before, and in return, I got up when he was called to help rustle the horses. We had every horse under hand before the sun peeped over the eastern horizon, and when returning to camp with the remuda, as I rode through a bunch of sumac bush, I found a wild turkey's nest with 16 fresh eggs in it. Honeyman rode up, when I dismounted, and putting them in my hat, handed them up to Billy until I could mount, for they were beauties and were as precious to us as gold. There was an egg for each man in the outfit, and one left over, and McCann threw a heap of swagger into the inquiry. "Gentlemen, how will you have your eggs this morning?" Just as though it was an everyday affair. They were issued to us fried, and I naturally felt that the odd egg, by rights, ought to fall to me. But the opposing majority was formidable, 14-1, so I yielded. A number of ways were suggested to allot the odd egg, but the gambling fever in us being rabid, raffling or playing cards for it seemed to be the proper caper. Raffling had few advocates. "It reflects on any man's raising," said Quince Forrest contemptuously, "to suggest the idea of raffling when we've got cards and all night to play for that egg. The very idea of raffling for it. I'd like to see myself pulling straws or drawing numbers from a hat, like some giggling girl at a church fair. Poker is a science. The highest court in Texas has said so. And I want some little show for my interest in that speckled egg." What have I spent 20 years learning the game for? Will some of you tell me? Why, it lets me out if you raffle it. The argument remained unanswered, and the play for it gave interest to the night. As soon as supper was over, and the first guard had taken the herd, the poker game opened, each man being given 10 beans for chips. We had only one deck of cards, so one game was all that could be run at a time. But there were 6 players, and when one was frozen out, another sat in and took his place. As wood was plentiful, we had a good fire, and this, with the aid of the cook's lantern, gave an abundance of light. We unrolled a bed to serve as a table, sat down on it Indian fashion, and as fast as one seat was vacated, there was a man ready to fill it, for we were impatient for our turns in the game. The talk turned on an accident which had happened that afternoon. When we were crossing the North Fork of the Canadian, Bob Blades attempted to ride out of the river below the crossing when his horse bogged down. He instantly dismounted, and his horse, after floundering around, scrambled out and up the bank, but with a broken leg. Our foreman had ridden up and ordered the horse unsaddled and shot to put him out of his suffering. While waiting our turns, the accident to the horse was referred to several times, and finally, Blades, who was sitting in the game, turned to us who were lounging around the fire and asked, "Did y'all notice that look he gave me as I was uncinching the saddle? If he'd been human, he might have told me what that look meant. Good thing he was a horse and couldn't realize." From then on, the yarning and conversation was strictly about horses. "It was always a mystery to me," said Billy Honeyman, "how a Mexican vaquero or Indian knows so much more about a horse than any of us gringos. I've seen them trail a horse across a country for miles, riding in a long lope, with not a trace or sign visible to me. I was helping a horseman once to drive a herd of horses to San Antonio from the lower Rio Grande country. We were driving them to market, and as there were no railroads south then, we had to take along saddle horses to ride home on after disposing of the herd. We always took favorite horses, which we didn't wish to sell, generally 2 apiece for that purpose. This time, when we were at least 100 miles from the ranch, a Mexican fella, who brought along a pet horse to ride home, thought he wouldn't hobble his pet one night, fancying the animal wouldn't leave the others. Well, next morning, his pet was missing. We scoured the country around, and the trail we'd come over for 10 miles, but no horse. As the country was all open, we felt positive he would go back to the ranch. 2 days later, and about 40 miles higher up the road, the Mexican was riding in the lead of the herd, when suddenly he reined in his horse, throwing him back on his haunches, and waved for some of us to come over to him, never taking his eyes off what he saw on the road. The owner was riding on one point of the herd, and I on the other. We hurried around to him, and both rode up at the same time, when that vaquero blurted out, 'There's my horse's track.' 'What horse?' asked the owner. 'My own, the horse we lost 2 days ago,' replied the Mexican. 'How do you know it's your horse's track from the thousands of others that fill the road?' demanded his employer. 'Don Tomas,' said the Aztec, lifting his hat, 'how do I know your step or voice from 1,000 others?' We laughed at him. He had been a peon, and that made him respect our opinions. Well, at least he avoided differing with us. But, as we drove on that afternoon, we could see him in the lead, watching for that horse's track. Several times, he turned in his saddle and looked back, pointing to some track in the road, and lifted his hat to us. At camp that night, we tried to draw him out, but he was silent. But when we were nearing San Antonio, we overtook a number of wagons loaded with wool, lying over, as it was Sunday, and there among their horses and mules was our Mexican's missing horse. The owner of the wagons explained how he came to have the horse. The animal had come to his camp one morning, back about 20 miles from where we'd lost him, while he was feeding grain to his work stock, and being a pet, insisted on being fed. Since then, I've always had a lot of respect for a Mexican cowboy's opinion regarding a horse. "Turkey eggs is too rich for my blood," said Bob Blades, rising from the game. "I don't care a continental who wins the egg now, for whenever I get three queens pat beat by a four-card draw, I have misgivings about the deal, and old Quince thinks he can stack cards. He couldn't stack hay." "Speaking about Mexicans and Indians," said Wyatt Roundtree, "I've got more use for a good horse than I have for either of those grades of humanity. I'd a little experience over east here, on the cutoff from the Chisholm Trail, a few years ago, that gave me all the Injun I want for some time to come. A band of renegade Cheyennes had hung along the trail for several years, scaring or begging passing herds into giving them a beef. Of course, all the cattle herds had more or less strays among them, so it was easier to cut out one of these than to argue the matter. There was plenty of herds on the trail then, so this band of Indians got bolder than bandits. In the year I'm speaking of, I went up with a herd of horses belonging to a Texas man who was in charge with us. When we came along with our horses, only six men all told, the chief of the band, named Running Bull Sheep, got on a bluff bigger than a wolf and demanded six horses. Well, that Texan wasn't looking for any particular Injun that day to give six of his own dear horses to. So we just drove on, paying no attention to Mr. Bull Sheep. About half a mile further up the trail, the chief overtook us with all his bucks, and they were an ugly-looking lot. Well, this time he held up four fingers, meaning that four horses would be acceptable. But the Texan wasn't recognizing the Indian levy of taxation that year. When he refused them, the Indians never parleyed a moment, but set up a "Kai-yee!" and began circling around the herd on their ponies, Bull Sheep in the lead. As the chief passed the owner, his horse on a run, he gave a special shrill "Kai-yee!" whipped a short carbine out of its scabbard, and shot twice into the rear of the herd. Never for a moment considering consequences, the Texan brought his six-shooter into action. It was a long, purty shot, and Mr. Bull Sheep threw his hands in the air and came off his horse backward, hard hit. This shooting in the rear of the horses gave them such a scare that we never checked them short of a mile. While the other Indians were holding a little powwow over their chief, we were making good time in the other direction, considering that we had over 800 loose horses. Fortunately, our wagon and saddle horses had gone ahead that morning, but in the run, we overtook them. As soon as we checked the herd from its scare, we turned them up the trail, stretching ropes from the wheels of the wagon, ran the saddle horses in, and changed mounts just a little quicker than I ever saw it done before or since. The cook had a saddle in the wagon, so we caught him up a horse, clapped leather on him, and tied him behind the wagon in case of an emergency. And you can just bet we changed to our best horses. When we overtook the herd, we were at least a mile and a half from where the shooting occurred. There was no Indian in sight, but we felt that they hadn't given it up. We hadn't long to wait, though we would have waited willingly, before we heard their yells and saw the dust rising in clouds behind us. We quit the herd and the wagon right there and rode for a swell of ground ahead that would give us a rear view of the scenery. The first view we caught of them was not very encouraging. They were riding after us like fiends and kicking up a dust like a windstorm. We had nothing but six-shooters, no good for long range. The owner of the horses admitted that it was useless to try to save the herd now, and if our scalps were worth saving, it was high time to make ourselves scarce. Cantonment was a government post about 25 miles away, so we rode for it. Our horses were good Spanish stock, and the Indians' little bench-legged ponies were no match for them. But not satisfied with the wagon and herd falling into their hands, they followed us until we were within sight of the post. As hard luck would have it, the cavalry stationed at this post were off on some escort duty, and the infantry were useless in this case. When the cavalry returned a few days later, we tried to round up those Indians, and the Indian agent used his influence, but the horses were so divided up and scattered that they were never recovered.
"And did the man lose his horses entirely?" asked Flood, who had anteed up his last bean and joined us.
"He did. There was, I remember, a tin-horn lawyer up about Dodge who thought he could recover their value, as these were agency Indians, and the government owed them money. But all I got for 3 months' wages due me was the horse I got away on."
McCann had been frozen out during Roundtree's yarn, and had joined the crowd of storytellers on the other side of the fire. Forrest was feeling quite gala, and took especial delight in taunting the vanquished as they dropped out.
"Is McCann there?" inquired he, well knowing he was. "I just wanted to ask, would it be any trouble to poach that egg for my breakfast, and serve it with a bit of toast? I'm feeling a little bit dainty. You'll poach it for me, won't you, please?"
McCann never moved a muscle as he replied, "Will you please go to hell?"
The storytelling continued for some time, and while Fox Quarternight was regaling us with the history of a little black mare that a neighbor of theirs in Kentucky owned, a dispute arose in the card game regarding the rules of discard and draw.
"I'm too old a girl," said the rebel, angrily, to Forrest, "to allow a pullet like you to teach me this game. When it's my deal, I'll discard just when I please, and it's none of your business so long as I keep within the rules of the game." Which sounded final, and the game continued.
Quarternight picked up the broken thread of his narrative, and the first warning we had of the lateness of the hour was Bull Durham calling to us up from the game.
"One of you fellas can have my place just as soon as we play this jackpot. I've got to saddle my horse and get ready for our guard. Oh, I'm on velvet, you know, and before this game ends, I'll make old Quince curl his tail. I've got him going south now."
It took me only a few minutes to lose my chance at the turkey egg, so I sought my blankets. At 1 a.m., when our guard was called, the beans were almost equally divided among Priest, Stallings, and Durham. In view of the fact that Forrest, whom we all wanted to see beaten, had met defeat, they all agreed to cut the cards for the egg, Stallings winning. We mounted our horses and rode out into the night, and the second guard rode back to our campfire. At Camp Supply, Flood received a letter from Lovell requesting him to come on into Dodge ahead of the cattle. So after the first night's camp above the Cimarron, Flood caught up a favorite horse, informed the outfit that he was going to quit us for a few days, and designated Quince Forrest as the segundo during his absence.
"You have a wide open country from here into Dodge," said he, when ready to start. "I'll make inquiry for you daily from men coming in, or from the buckboard which carries the mail to Camp Supply. I'll try to meet you at Mulberry Creek, which is about 10 miles south of Dodge. I'll make that town tonight, and you ought to make the Mulberry in 2 days. You'll see the smoke of passing trains to the north of the Arkansas from the first divide south of Mulberry. When you reach that creek, in case I don't meet you, hold the herd there, and 3-4 of you can come into town." "But I'm almost certain to meet you," he called back as he rode away.
"Priest," said Quince, when our foreman had gone, "I reckon you didn't handle your herd to suit the old man when he left us that time at Buffalo Gap.
but I think he used rare judgment this time in selecting a segundo. The only thing that frets me is, I'm afraid he'll meet us before we reach the Mulberry, and that won't give me any chance to go in ahead like a sure enough foreman. Fact is, I have business there. I deposited a few months' wages at the Long Branch Gambling House last year when I was in Dodge, and I failed to take a receipt. I just want to drop in and make inquiry if they gave me credit and if the account is drawing interest. I think it's all right, for the man I deposited it with was a clever fellow and asked me to have a drink with him just as I was leaving. Still, I'd like to step in and see him again. Early in the afternoon of the second day, after our foreman left us, we sighted the smoke of passing trains, though they were at least 15 miles distant, and long before we reached the Mulberry, a livery rig came down the trail to meet us. To Forrest's chagrin, Flood, all dressed up and with a white collar on, was the driver, while on a back seat sat Dan Lovell and another cowman by the name of McNulta. Every rascal of us gave old man Don the glad hand as they drove around the herd, while he, liberal and delighted as a bridegroom, passed out the cigars by the handful. The cattle were looking fine, which put the old man in high spirits, and he inquired of each of us if our health was good and if Flood had fed us well. They loitered around the herd the rest of the evening until we threw off the trail to graze and camp for the night, when Lovell declared his intention of staying all night with the outfit. While we were catching horses during the evening, Lovell came up to me where I was saddling my night horse, and recognizing me, gave me news of my brother Bob. "I had a letter yesterday from him," he said, "written from Red Fork, which is just north of the Cimarron River, over on the Chisholm route. He reports everything going along nicely, and I'm expecting him to show up here within a week. His herd are all beef steers, and are contracted for delivery at the Crow Indian Agency. He's not driving as fast as Flood, but we've got to have our beef for that delivery in better condition, as they have a new agent there this year, and he may be one of these knowing fellas. Sorry you couldn't see your brother, but if you have any word to send him, I will deliver it." I thanked him for the interest he had taken in me, and assured him that I had no news for Robert, but took advantage of the opportunity to inquire if our middle brother, Zach Quirk, was on the trail with any of his herds. Lovell knew him, but felt positive he was not with any of his outfits. We had an easy night with the cattle. Lovell insisted on standing a guard, so he took Rod Wheat's horse and stood the first watch. And after returning to the wagon, he and McNulta, to our great interest, argued the merits of the different trails until near midnight. McNulta had two herds coming in on the Chisholm Trail, while Lovell had two herds on the Western and only one on the Chisholm. The next morning, Forrest, who was again in charge, received orders to cross the Arkansas River shortly after noon, and then let half the outfit come into town. The old trail crossed the river about a mile above the present town of Dodge City, Kansas. So when we changed horses at noon, the first and second guards caught up their top horses, ransacked their war bags, and donned their best toggery. We crossed the river about 1 o'clock in order to give the boys a good holiday, the stage of water making the river easily fordable. McCann, after dinner was over, drove down to the south side for the benefit of a bridge which spanned the river opposite the town. It was the first bridge he had been able to take advantage of in over 1,000 miles of travel, and today he spurned the cattle ford as though he had never crossed at one. Once safely over the river, and with the understanding that the herd would camp for the night, about 6 miles north on Duck Creek, 6 of our men quit us and rode for the town in a long gallop. Before the rig left us in the morning, McNulta, who was thoroughly familiar with Dodge,
and an older man than Lovell. In a friendly and fatherly spirit, seeing that many of us were youngsters, had given us an earnest talk and plenty of good advice.
"I've been in Dodge every summer since 77, said the old cowman, "and I can give you boys some points. Dodge is one town where the average bad man of the West not only finds his equal, but finds himself badly handicapped. The buffalo hunters and the range men have protested against the iron rule of Dodge's peace officers, and nearly every protest has cost human life. Don't ever get the impression that you can ride your horses into a saloon or shoot out the light in Dodge. It may go somewhere else, but it sure don't go there. So, I want to warn you to behave yourselves. You can wear your six-shooters into town, but you'd better leave them at the first place you stop, hotel, livery, or business house. And when you leave town, call for your pistols, but don't ride out shooting. Omit that. Most cowboys think it's an infringement on their rights to give up shooting in town, and if it is, it stands, for your six-shooters are no match for Winchesters and buckshot, and Dodge's officers are as game a set of men as ever faced danger." Nearly a generation has passed since McNulta, the Texas cattle drover, gave our outfit this advice one June morning on the Mulberry. In setting down this record, I have only to scan the roster of the peace officials of Dodge City to admit its correctness. Among the names that graced the official roster during the brief span of the trail days were the brothers Ed, Jim, and Bat Masterson, Wyatt Earp, Jack Bridges, Doc Holliday, Charles Bassett, William Tillman, Shotgun Collins, Joshua Webb, Mayor A. B. Webster, and mysterious Dave Mather. The puppets of no romance ever written can compare with these officers in fearlessness. And let it be understood, there were plenty to protest against their rule. Almost daily during the range season, some equally fearless individual defied them. "Throw up your hands and surrender," said an officer to a Texas cowboy who had spurred an excitable horse until it was rearing and plunging in the street, leveling meanwhile a double-barreled shotgun at the horseman. "Not to you, you white-livered son of a bitch," was the instant reply, accompanied by a shot. The officer staggered back, mortally wounded, but recovered himself, and the next instant the cowboy reeled from his saddle, a load of buckshot through his breast. After the boys left us for town, the remainder of us, belonging to the 3rd and 4th Guard, grazed the cattle forward leisurely during the afternoon. Through cattle herds were in sight both up and down the river on either side. On crossing the Mulberry the day before, we learned that several herds were holding out as far south as that stream. Well, McNulta had reported over 40 herds as having already passed northward on the trail. Dodge was the meeting point for buyers from every quarter. Often, herds would sell at Dodge, whose destination for delivery was beyond the Yellowstone in Montana. Herds frequently changed owners when the buyer never saw the cattle. A yearling was a yearling, and a two-year-old was a two-year-old, and the seller's word that they were as good or better than the string I sold you last year was sufficient. Cattle were classified as northern, central, and southern animals, and, except in case of severe drought in the preceding years, were pretty nearly uniform in size throughout each section. The prairie section of the state left its indelible imprint on the cattle bred in the open country, while the coast, as well as the piney woods and blackjack sections, did the same, thus making classification easy. McCann overtook us early in the evening, and, being an obliging fellow, was induced by Forrest to stand the first guard with Honeyman so as to make up the proper number of watches.
though with only two men on guard at a time, for it was hardly possible that any of the others would return before daybreak. There was much to be seen in Dodge, and as losing a night's sleep on duty was considered nothing, in hilarious recreation, sleep would be entirely forgotten. McCann had not forgotten us, but had smuggled out a quart bottle to cut the alkali in our drinking water. But a quart amongst eight of us was not dangerous, so the night passed without incident, though we felt a growing impatience to get into town. As we expected, about sunrise the next morning, our men off on holiday rode into camp, having never closed an eye during the entire night. They brought word from Flood that the herd would only graze over to Saw Log Creek that day, so as to let the remainder of us have a day and a night in town. Lovell would only advance half a month's wages, $25, to each man. It was ample for any personal needs, though we had nearly 3 months' wages due, and no one protested, for the old man was generally right in his decisions. According to their report, the boys had had a hog-killing time, old man Don having been out with them all night. It seems that McNulta stood in well with a class of practical jokers, which included the officials of the town, and whenever there was anything on the tapis, he always got the word for himself and friends. During breakfast, Fox Quarternight told this incident of the evening. Some professor, a professor in the occult sciences, I think he called himself, had written to the mayor to know what kind of a point Dodge would be for a lecture. The lecture was to be free, but he also intimated that he had a card or two on the side up his sleeve, by which he expected to graft onto some of the coin of the realm from the wayfaring man as well as the citizen. The mayor turned the letter over to Bat Masterson, the city marshal, who answered it, and invited the professor to come on, assuring him that he was deeply interested in the occult sciences, personally, and would take pleasure in securing him a hall and a date, besides announcing his coming through the paper. He was billed to deliver his lecture last night. Those old longhorns, McNulta and Lovell, got us in with the crowd, and while they didn't know exactly what was coming, they assured us that we couldn't afford to miss it. Well, at the appointed hour in the evening, the hall was packed, not over half being able to find seats. It's safe to say that there were over 500 men present, as it was announced for men only. Every gambler in town was there, with a fair sprinkling of cowmen and our tribe. At the appointed hour, Masterson, as chairman, rapped for order, and in a neat little speech, announced the object of the meeting. Bat mentioned the lack of interest in the West in the higher arts and sciences, and bespoke our careful attention to the subject under consideration for the evening. He said he felt it hardly necessary to urge the importance of good order. But if anyone had come out of idle curiosity or bent on mischief, as chairman of the meeting and a peace officer of the city, he would certainly brook no interruption. After a few other appropriate remarks, he introduced the speaker as Dr. J. Graves Brown, the noted scientist. That professor was an oily-tongued fella and led off on the prelude to his lecture, while the audience was as quiet as mice and as grave as owls. After he'd spoken for about 5 minutes and was getting warmed up to his subject, he made an assertion which sounded a little fishy, and someone back in the audience blurted out, "That's a damned lie!" The speaker halted in his discourse and looked at Masterson, who arose and, drawing 2 6-shooters, looked the audience over as if trying to locate the offender. Laying the guns down on the table, he informed the meeting that another interruption would cost the offender his life, if he had to follow him to the Rio Grande or the British possessions. He then asked the professor, as there would be no further interruptions, to proceed with the lecture. The professor hesitated about going on, when Masterson assured him that it was evident that his audience, with the exception of one skulking coyote, was deeply interested in the subject, and that no one man could interfere with the freedom of speech in Dodge, as long as it was a free country, and he was city marshal. Anyway, after this little talk, the speaker braced up and launched out again on his lecture. When he was once more under good headway, he had occasion to relate an exhibition which he had witnessed while studying his profession in India. The incident related was a trifle rank for anyone to swallow raw, when the same party who'd interrupted before sang out, "That's another damned lie!" Masterson came to his feet like a flash, a gun in each hand, saying, "Stand up, you measly skunk, so I can see you." Half a dozen men rose in different parts of the house and cut loose at him, and as they did so, the lights went out and the room filled with smoke. Masterson was blazing away with two guns, which so lighted up the rostrum that we could see the professor crouching under the table. Of course, they were using blank cartridges. But the audience raised the long yell and poured out through the windows and doors, and the lecture was over. A couple of police came in later, so McNulty said, escorted the professor to his room in the hotel, and quietly advised him that Dodge, unfortunately, was hardly capable of appreciating anything so advanced as a lecture on the occult sciences. Breakfast over, Honeyman ran in the remuda, and we caught the best horses in our mounts, on which to pay our respects to Dodge. Forrest detailed Rod Wheat to wrangle the horses, for we intended to take Honeyman with us. As it was only about 6 miles over to the Saw Log, Quince advised that they graze along Duck Creek until after dinner, and then graze over to the former stream during the afternoon. Before leaving, we rode over and looked out the trail after it left Duck, for it was quite possible that we might return during the night. We requested McCann to hang out the lantern, elevated on the end of the wagon tongue, as a beacon. After taking our bearings, we reined southward over the divide to Dodge. "The very first thing I do," said Quince Forrest, as we rode leisurely along, "after I get a shave and a haircut, and by what few tricks I need, is to hunt up that gambler in the Long Branch and ask him to take a drink with me. I took the parting one on him. Then I'll simply set in and win back every dollar I lost there last year. There's something in this northern air that I breathe in this morning that tells me that this is my lucky day. You other kids had better let the games alone and save your money to buy red silk handkerchiefs and soda water and such harmless gimcracks." The fact that the rebel was 10 years his senior never entered his mind as he gave us this fatherly advice, though to be sure the majority of us were his juniors in years. On reaching Dodge, we rode up to the Wright House, which, by my research, I've learned is the oldest dwelling in Dodge City, Kansas, standing today. Flood met us there and directed our cavalcade across the railroad to a livery stable, the proprietor of which was a friend of Lovell's. We unsaddled and turned our horses into a large corral, and while we were in the office of the livery, surrendering our artillery, Flood came in and handed each of us $25 in gold, warning us that when that was gone, no more would be advanced. On receipt of the money, we scattered like partridges before a gunner. Within an hour or two, we began to return to the stable by ones and twos, and were stowing into our saddle pockets our purchases, which ran from needles and thread to 45 cartridges. Every mother's son, reflecting the art of the barber, while John Officer had his blonde mustaches blackened, waxed, and curled like a French dancing master. "If some of you boys will hold him," said Moss Strayhorn, commenting on Officer's appearance, "I'd like to take a good smell of him, just to see if he took oil up there where the end of his neck's haired over." as Officer had already had several drinks, comfortably stowed away under his belt, and stood up strong 6'2", none of us volunteered. After packing away our plunder, we sauntered around town, drinking moderately and visiting the various saloons and gambling houses. I clung to my bunkie, the rebel, during the rounds, for I had learned to like him and had confidence he would lead me into no indiscretions. At the Long Branch, we found Quince Forrest and Wyatt Browntree playing the faro bank, the former keeping cases. They never recognized us, but were answering a great many questions asked by the dealer and lookout regarding the possible volume of the cattle drive that year. Down at another gambling house, the rebel met Ben Thompson, a faro dealer not on duty, and an old cavalry comrade, and the two cronied around for over an hour like long-lost brothers, pledging anew their friendship over several social glasses, in which I was always included. There was no telling how long this reunion would have lasted, but happily, for my sake, Lovell, who'd been asleep all the morning, started out to round us up for dinner with him at the Wright House, which was at that day a famous hostelry, patronized almost exclusively by the Texas cowmen and cattle buyers. We made the rounds of the gambling houses, looking for our crowd. We ran across three of the boys piking at a Monte game, who came with us reluctantly. Then, guided by Lovell, we started for the Long Branch, where we felt certain we would find Forrest and Quince, if they had any money left. Forrest was broke, which made him ready to come, and Roundtree, though quite a winner, out of deference to our employer's wishes, cashed in and joined us. Old man Don could hardly do enough for us, and before we could reach the Wright House, had lined us up against three different bars. While I had confidence in my navigable capacity, I found they were coming just a little too fast and free, seeing I had scarcely drunk anything in 3 months but branch water. As we lined up at the Wright House bar for the final before dinner, the rebel, who was standing next to me, entered a waiver and took a cigar, which I understood to be a hint, and I did likewise. We had a splendid dinner. Our outfit, with McNulta, occupied a 10-chair table, while on the opposite side of the room was another large table, occupied principally by drovers who were waiting for their herds to arrive. Among those at the latter table, whom I now remember, was Uncle Henry Stevens, Jesse Ellison, Lum Slaughter, John Blocker, Ike Pryor, Dunn Houston, and last, but not least, Colonel Shanghai Pierce. The latter was possibly the most widely known cowman between the Rio Grande and the British possessions. He stood 6'4" in his stockings, was gaunt and raw-boned, and the possessor of a voice which, even in ordinary conversation, could be distinctly heard across the street. "No, I'll not ship any more cattle to your town," said Pierce to a cattle solicitor during the dinner, his voice in righteous indignation resounding like a foghorn through the dining room. "Until you adjust your yardage charges. Listen, I can go right up into the heart of your city and get a room for myself with a nice clean bed in it, plenty of soap, water, and towels, and I can occupy that room for 24 hours for 2 bits. And your stockyards, away out in the suburbs, want to charge me 20 cents a head and let my steers stand out in the weather." After dinner, all the boys, with the exception of Priest and myself, returned to the gambling houses as though anxious to work overtime. Before leaving the hotel, Forrest effected the loan of $10 from Roundtree, and the two returned to the Long Branch, while the others as eagerly sought out a Monte game. But I was fascinated with the conversation of these old cowmen, and sat around for several hours listening to their yarns and cattle talk. "I was selling 1,000 beef steers one time to some Yankee army contractors," Pierce was narrating to a circle of listeners, and I got the idea that they were not up to snuff in receiving cattle out on the prairie. I was holding a herd of about 3,000, and they had agreed to take a running cut, which showed that they had the receiving agent fixed. Well, my foreman and I were counting the cattle as they came between us, but the steers were wild, long-legged coasters, and came through between us like scared wolves. I'd lost the count several times, but guessed at them and started over, the cattle still coming like a whirlwind. When I thought, oh, about 900 had passed us, I cut them off and sang out, "Here they come and there they go. Just an even 1,000, by Gatlin's. What do you make it, Bill?" "Just an even 1,000, Colonel," replied my foreman. Of course, the contractors were counting at the same time, and I suppose didn't like to admit they couldn't count 1,000 cattle where anybody else could, and never asked for a recount, but accepted and paid for them. They'd hired an outfit and held the cattle outside that night, but the next day, when they cut them into car lots and shipped them, they were 118 short. They wanted to come back on me to make them good, but shucks, I wasn't responsible if their Jim Crow outfit lost the cattle. Along early in the evening, Flood advised us boys to return to the herd with him, but all the crowd wanted to stay in town and see the sights. Lovell interceded in our behalf and promised to see that we left town in good time to be in camp before the herd was ready to move the next morning. On this assurance, Flood saddled up and started for the saw log, having ample time to make the ride before dark. By this time, most of the boys had worn off the wire edge for gambling and were comparing notes. Three of them were broke, but Prince Forrest had turned the tables and was over a clean $100 winner for the day. Those who had no money fortunately had good credit with those of us who had, for there was yet much to be seen, and in Dodge, in 82, it took money to see the elephant. There were several variety theaters, a number of dance halls, and other resorts, which, like the wicked, flourish best under darkness. After supper, just about dusk, we went over to the stable, caught our horses, saddled them, and tied them up for the night. We fully expected to leave town by 10, for it was a good 12-mile ride to the saw log. In making the rounds of the variety theaters and dance halls, we hung together. Lovell excused himself early in the evening, and at parting, we assured him that the outfit would leave for camp before midnight. We were enjoying ourselves immensely over at the Lone Star Dance Hall when an incident occurred in which we entirely neglected the good advice of McNulta and had the sensation of hearing lead whistle and cry around our ears before we got away from town. Quince Forrest was spending his winnings as well as drinking freely, and at the end of a quadrille gave vent to his hilarity in an old-fashioned Comanche yell. The bouncer of the dance hall, of course, had his eye on our crowd, and at the end of a change took Quince to task. He was a surly brute, and instead of couching his request in appropriate language, threatened to throw him out of the house. Forrest stood, like one, absent-minded and took the abuse, for physically he was no match for the bouncer, who was armed, moreover, and wore an officer's star. I was dancing in the same set with a red-headed, freckle-faced girl who clutched my arm and wished to know if my friend was armed. I assured her that he was not, or we would have had notice of it before the bouncer's invective was ended. At the conclusion of the dance, Quince and the rebel sauntered out, giving the rest of us the word to remain as though nothing was wrong. In the course of half an hour, Priest returned and asked us to take our leave one at a time without attracting any attention and meet at the stable. I remained until the last and noticed the rebel and the bouncer taking a drink together at the bar, the former apparently in a most amiable mood. We passed out together shortly afterward, and found the other boys mounted and awaiting our return, it being now about midnight. It took but a moment to secure our guns, and once in the saddle, we rode through the town in the direction of the herd. On the outskirts of the town, we halted.
"I'm going back to that dance hall," said Forrest, "and have one round at least with that whore herder. No man who walks this old earth can insult me as he did, not if he has 100 stars on him. If any of you don't want to go along, ride right on to camp, but I'd like to have y'all go. And when I take his measure, it'll be the signal to the rest of you to put out the lights. All that's going, come on."
There were no dissenters to the program. I saw at a glance that my bunkie was heart and soul in the play, and took my cue and kept my mouth shut. We circled round the town to a vacant lot within a block of the rear of the dance hall. Honeyman was left to hold the horses. Then, taking off our belts and hanging them on the pommels of our saddles, we secreted our six-shooters inside the waistbands of our trousers. The hall was still crowded with the revelers when we entered, a few at a time, Forrest and Priest being the last to arrive. Forrest had changed hats with the rebel, who always wore a black one, and as the bouncer circulated around, Quince stepped squarely in front of him. There was no waste of words, but a gun barrel flashed in the lamplight, and the bouncer, struck with the six-shooter, fell like a beef. Before the bedeviled spectators could raise a hand, 5 six-shooters were turned into the ceiling. The lights went out at the first fire, and amidst the rush of men and the screaming of women, we reached the outside, and within a minute were in our saddles. All would have gone well had we returned by the same route and avoided the town, but, after crossing the railroad track, anger and pride having not been properly satisfied, we must ride through the town. On entering the main street, leading north and opposite the bridge on the river, somebody of our party in the rear turned his gun loose into the air. The rebel and I were riding in the lead. At the clattering of hoofs and shooting behind us, our horses started on the run, the shooting by this time having become general. At the second street crossing, I noticed a rope of fire belching from a Winchester in the doorway of a store building. There was no doubt in my mind, but we were the object of the manipulator of that carbine, and as we reached the next cross street, a man kneeling in the shadow of a building opened fire on us with a six-shooter. Priest reined in his horse, and not having wasted cartridges in the open-air shooting, returned the compliment until he emptied his gun. By this time, every officer in the town was throwing lead at us, some of which cried a little too close for comfort. When there was no longer any shooting on our flanks, we turned into a cross street and soon left the lead behind us. At the outskirts of the town, we slowed up our horses and took it leisurely for a mile or so, when Quince Forrest halted us and said,
"I'm going to drop out here and see if anyone follows us. I want to be alone, so that if any officers try to follow us up, I can have it out with them."
As there was no time to lose in parleying, and as he had a good horse, we rode away and left him. On reaching camp, we secured a few hours' sleep, but the next morning, to our surprise, Forrest failed to appear. We explained the situation to Flood, who said if he did not show up by noon, he would go back and look for him. We all felt positive that he would not dare to go back to town, and, if he was lost, as soon as the sun arose, he'd be able to get his bearings. While we were nooning about 7 miles north of the saw log, someone noticed a buggy coming up the trail. As it came nearer, we saw that there were 2 other occupants of the rig besides the driver. When it drew up, old Quince, still wearing the rebel's hat, stepped out of the rig, dragged out his saddle from under the seat, and invited his companions to dinner. They both declined when Forrest, taking out his purse, handed a $20 gold piece to the driver with an oath. He then asked the other man what he owed him, but the latter very haughtily declined any recompense, and the conveyance drove away.
"I suppose you fellows don't know what all this means," said Quince, as he filled the plate and sat down in the shade of the wagon. "Well, that horse of mine got a bullet plugged into him last night as we were leaving town, and before I could get him to Duck Creek, he died on me. I carried my saddle and blankets until daylight, when I hid in a draw and waited for something to turn up. I thought some of you would come back and look for me sometime, for I knew you wouldn't understand it, when all of a sudden here comes this livery rig along with that drummer, going out to Jetmore, I believe he said. I explained what I wanted, but he decided that his business was more important than mine, and refused me. I referred the matter to Judge Colt, and the judge decided that it was more important that I overtake this herd. I'd have made him take pay, too, only he acted so mean about it." After dinner, fearing arrest, Forrest took a horse and rode on ahead to the Solomon River. We were a glum outfit that afternoon, but after a good night's rest, were again as fresh as daisies. When McCann started to get breakfast, he hung his coat on the end of the wagon rod while he went for a bucket of water. During his absence, John Officer was noticed slipping something into Barney's coat pocket. And after breakfast, when our cook went to his coat for his tobacco, he unearthed a lady's cambric handkerchief, nicely embroidered, and a silver-mounted garter. He looked at the articles a moment, and, grasping the situation at a glance, ran his eye over the outfit for the culprit. But there was not a word or a smile. He walked over and threw the articles into the fire, remarking, "Good whiskey and bad women will be the ruin of you varmints yet." And that completes today's reading from The Log of a Cowboy, a narrative of the old trail days, by Andy Adams. Thank you for joining us once again for Western Short Stories. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
That old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloudy draw. High